Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. My guest today is an associate professor of astronomy and the director of something called the Institute for Pale Blue Dots at Cornell University. Until recently, she was a lecturer at Harvard University and at the University of Heidelberg in Germany. She studies exoplanets, which is planets that are other than our own, right? So external planets. In fact, that explains the blue dots in the name of her institute. In particular, she looks for planets that have many features that are Earth-like and which could potentially support some form of life as we know it on Earth. Probably the thing she's best known for in astronomical circles is for pioneering a new way of looking at the Earth as someone observing it from far away in space might see it, and as it has evolved over time, right? And applying then those models of how the Earth has evolved to how we in turn see exoplanets. Her name is Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger. And as I say, she's a professor at Cornell University, a professor of astronomy. Welcome, Dr. Kaltenegger.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on show, Court.
So nice to have you on, and I hope we can call you Lisa.
Of course.
Good. So, this new perspective on planetary evolution that I described just a minute ago, that Lisa has pretty much invented, has led her then to develop something she calls the Alien ID Chart, which is not a wall chart of how aliens look, but it's something to do with exoplanets and how they look and maybe how the Earth looks also. So it's a way of categorizing kind of a nomenclature of planets, I think, right? But Lisa, can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So the real fascinating thing, especially for me, and I'm a bit biased, you have to be careful because I work on this, but
okay. We
live for the first time in human history, we live in a time where we can actually find other worlds out there orbiting other stars, other suns. So every star you see out there at night, of course, is another sun. So we already finding those. It's not just a philosophical discussion over a glass of wine whether or not there could be other worlds out there and whether or not they could be like ours. For the first time in history, we actually have the tools in hand to find planets around other suns. And so now the fascinating question is how many of those could be potentially like our own planet? And in that regard, we were saying, well, we know what our planet looks like, right? Because we have all the satellites in space. We know what the weather is roughly, you know. You know, I never know if it's going to rain tomorrow or not, but roughly, you know, in a month, we know if it's getting really cold or really warm. And so then the question is, if you look out there and if among the planets that we already found around different stars, other suns, they are actually small ones, how could we pick out if there's life on these planets? And taking a look at our own planet, it of course changed a lot in the 4.5 billion years that it used to evolve. So basically it was formed, it was really hot, then it cooled down, we had water, and then life evolved pretty early on. But the atmosphere, or the air that you breathe, evolved very differently. So in the beginning we had a lot of carbon dioxide and other things, and then about half of Earth's history, oxygen started to build up in the atmosphere, and that's basically why we can breathe it right now. So the question was, if you found such a planet around another sun, what would be the telltale signs that could tell you basically how old it is, if you want? And so we looked at our own planet, the Earth. We looked how it evolved. We know the rock record for that. And then using all that, we put together a model, an atmospheric model, like the one that predicts whether it's rains or not, to figure out if you would look at another Earth that's younger than we are, what would we see? And could you figure out whether or not life has already started? And then, of course, the next question is, like, what about bacteria, dinosaurs, or intelligent life, hopefully, as we know it?
Hmm. So what you've described is developing a model based on the, let's call it, evolution of the Earth in its long history.
Absolutely.
And then applying that to exoplanets. But really then what you would be looking for using that model and those characteristics would be planets that are much like Earth. But is that, do you think, a normal or standard evolutionary progression in planets? Or could there be other ways that planets might evolve and still support life?
See, this is a really interesting question, right? That's completely open. And we're basically looking to figure out, you know, what the answer to that is, because I can't really tell you. So what we do is we basically set these models up to say, okay, this is what the Earth would look like, and this is how you could tell if it's a young Earth, or a medium-age Earth, or an Earth as old as ours. But then, of course, we have to also look further and say, well, what about if the planet is a little bit different? And this is what the key part of our research here is. We say, well, the planet could be more massive, less massive, colder, hotter. And all these things would lead to completely different or to somehow different environments on that planet. And then the question is, could life still evolve there? And that's one that the biologists are trying to very, very hard to actually answer. And our question is, like, how could we see that remotely without flying there, because the distances are so vast, to figure out, exactly as you asked, whether or not the Earth is the standard in a planet's evolution, or if it's unique, or if it's, you know, an average planet. We don't know that yet, and this is why I think this whole search is so interesting, because there are so many fundamental questions completely open.
Well, of course, the things you're looking for are vast, vast distances away. So let's back up just a minute before we continue talking about the characteristics of planets to talk about how you actually find them. How do you search for them? Do you use ground-based telescopes or Earth-based telescopes or what? And how do you, how far out do you look? You know, basically, what instruments do you use and how do you use them? What do you look for?
Absolutely. So basically, what helps me a lot just to visualize this sometimes is, if you take our whole solar system, so all our planets, our sun is in the middle, and you shrink it to the size of a cookie. And here you just take an Oreo cookie or any small cookie that you right now are having with your coffee, because I do want you to remember astronomy every time now that you grab a cookie from somewhere. But just think about that.
Okay.
Small cookie, Oreo size roughly. That's the size of our solar system. Then the next star, just the next one, our neighboring star.
The closest one.
The closest one is more than 2 football fields away.
Yeah.
In that scale. And so how do we find planets, actually? Because it's vast distances. And so there have been 2 methods that we actually use most successfully. There are more than that, but the 2 that yielded the most planets, one is called the transit method. That is also what the big telescope from NASA that's called Kepler, it's a 1-meter telescope in space, used,
mm-hmm.
where I think a lot of people have heard all the really exciting news of planets found by Kepler. And basically what you use is, you have a star. A star is incredibly hot. Its surface is very, very hot. Nuclear fusion in the center of a star, so it's really, really hot surface of the star. So it's bright. If something is hot, it's bright and it shines a lot of light. So if you look at the star, it's bright. And then if the star periodically is less bright, that you can actually attribute that to a planet that goes around the star and blocks, while you're looking at this hot star, part of the hot surface, because it goes between us and that star.
Mm.
And this is what we call the transit, or an eclipse, if you want. And this is how we found hundreds to thousands, not, you know, we are at the thousands now, but we found hundreds of planets already with that method.
Wow.
And the second method that we use is actually something that we call the wobble method. And the wobble method is basically, when the planet goes around the star, it actually tucks at the star as well.
Hmm.
And you can think about it in a way, if you go walking with a dog, even if you don't see, or if you see somebody walk with a dog, but you don't see the dog, if the dog is really massive or big, you see that the person is getting dragged, right? A little bit. So you see that this person is not walking on its own. You see that it's actually hunching forward to hold the dog in a way. And so a planet that goes around the star also gravitationally tucks at the star a little bit. And so the star appears to wobble. And you can see that, again, in the star's position or in its light. And that's called radial velocity or wobble method. And the way we measure it is very similar to when a car or an ambulance comes towards you, goes away from you, the sound changes. That's the Doppler effect.
Mm-hmm.
That also works for light. And so this is how we use the Doppler effect, or the light of the star, to figure out if it moves back and forth. So basically counteracts the gravity of a planet that orbits around it.
Okay, gotcha. So you're looking for one of 2 things, either, I guess, depending on what instrument you're looking with and how you're looking, but you're looking at things very far away that are either flickering a little bit or they're wobbling a little bit, and you can infer the presence of a planet from that. So when you find a planet, that's far from saying that you found an Earth-like planet. So what characteristics do you look for when you find one of these very distant objects that you know is a planet or think is a planet around a star? What characteristics do you look for that make them Earth-like or potentially habitable.
You want it not to be too far away from its star, because there it would be freezingly cold. You don't get enough energy from the star to be warm. And you don't want it to be too close to the star, because if it's too close, then all the water you could have on a planet would evaporate, because it just would get so incredibly hot on the surface of that planet. And you want it to be small or not very massive, because in our own solar system, if you have a look, the rocky planets are pretty small in mass, but the Jupiter and Saturn have a lot of mass, so they actually accumulated a lot of gas as well. So what we're looking for is a planet that's not too far away and not too close to the star in the so-called Goldilocks or habitable zone. And we want one that's small enough, that's below 2 Earth radii or below 10 Earth masses roughly, so that it hasn't accumulated a lot of gas, so that it's not a Jupiter-like object where it's a gas ball, but it's actually a rocky object like our own Earth, or if you want, Mars, Venus, or Mercury.
Does it have to be able to support photosynthesis, do you think, to be potentially habitable in terms that we would recognize?
That's a fascinating question, actually. Photosynthesis only was around for about 500 million, or, you know, plants that actually covered most of the continent, I should say, were only around for about 500 million years in Earth's history. Yeah, for these 500 million years, basically, you could see them from space if you had a huge telescope. But before that, life was already there, right? We think life developed about 4 billion years ago, a bit less, but for a long, long time. So, and it did some photosynthesis at the end of its evolution, but not in the beginning. And also, a lot of life actually doesn't do photosynthesis. A lot of life actually use chemistry, chemical radiance, to actually get the energy. And the question whether or not you could see it to be able to detect it, so if you could see some plants on that planet, that would, of course, be easier for us to figure out that there's plant life like ours.
Sure.
But there's also really interesting kind of life forms on the Earth that's called extremophiles. So life that can actually live in very hostile environments for us, so very acid or very hot areas of the planet or in the desert. And so one of the parts that we're also doing here in our research group is trying to figure out what would happen if that kind of life were actually dominant on another planet. Would we be able to spot that as well? So not just plants, but also a lot of things like bacterial mats or some other interesting extremophiles. And so I don't think you need photosynthesis to tell that there's life on a planet, because what you're really looking for is gases in the atmosphere. On the other hand, if you wanted to find plants on another planet, then it would be really nice if we could actually see the reflectivity, the nice green leaves of plants on this other planet too. But you'd need a huge telescope to do that. So for now, we're concentrating on the atmosphere, the chemicals in the atmosphere, and what it tells us about whether or not life is on that planet.
It seems already amazing enough to be able to distinguish gases one from another at something that's far more than several football fields away in most cases. But can you actually distinguish water and so on at those distances? Can you tell atmosphere from water?
Yeah, you can actually tell in an atmosphere. You can tell what kind of components are in the atmosphere, so what you would be likely to breathe if you land there. And, of course, what we're looking for as a telltale sign of life on a planet, as we know it, as the Earth, we're looking for oxygen or ozone, doesn't really matter which one of the two, plus a reducing gas. And the key factor in this is if you have oxygen or ozone with a reducing gas, like methane, for example, they would actually react with each other and produce something like water and CO2. So if you find a planet that actually shows oxygen in its atmosphere and a reducing gas like methane, then you know that something produces oxygen in huge amounts. And that is, as far as we know, in huge amounts on a temperate planet, that would be life. And so you are asking, how do we find that? And the interesting thing is, if you think back in chemistry, you know that these different molecules have a different structure. Like, for example, water has like H2O, right, has two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom, and they are like connected. And so basically, if you put energy onto that, at a certain energy, it will start to swing or will start to rotate. Very specific energy, and energy, of course, is also light. So if you look at a planet very, very far away, you see that there's some light missing in the light that gets to you from its star. then that is because the light got filtered through the atmosphere of the planet and got taken up by these molecules to swing and rotate or basically put an electron in another orbital. But that is how we actually, over light years away, can tell what chemistry or what kind of molecules are in the atmosphere of a planet. And this is, of course, the absorption features that you learned about in school.
I agree. It's fascinating, and I think it's amazing, and probably most people don't really realize the kind of thing you've been describing, how advanced astronomical instruments are and what you can see at those enormous distances. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Professor Lisa Kaltenegger, who is an astronomer on the faculty at Cornell University and the director of the Institute for Pale Blue Dots, and those blue dots are distant stars that they study to look for planets around them. You mentioned, Lisa, at the beginning of the show that I guess we're working up around 1,000 planets that have now been discovered, but I've seen estimates that there could be around 40 billion Earth-like planets in the Milky Way galaxy alone. That's just one galaxy out of billions of galaxies, as Carl Sagan, also at Cornell University, used to say. What do you think about that estimate of, you know, billions and billions of planets, including Earth-like planets?
Absolutely. I think this is what makes my assigned line of work so much more fun to work in, because if you had one, that would probably be a kind of dire thing. You know, you had one thing to play with.
Yeah.
But we find, with all the estimates that we have, with all the search that we've done so far, we've already confirmed more than 1,800 planets as being planets, and we have thousands of candidates that we're still vetting, where we have a look whether or not it's an instrument error and so on and so forth, just to make 100% sure that they are really bona fide planets. And if you now extrapolate, because we've only looked at a certain amount of stars, and they're not that many. Kepler looks at 150,000 stars. If you extrapolate, what we find is actually that every second star out there should have at least a planet. And this sounds honky, but it's basically we haven't found the really small ones yet. And then if you look up in the night sky, you can see roughly about 6,000 stars in the night sky with your naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
That means, even though you can see them, there are roughly about 3,000 planets that you see from the Earth looking up. And then, as you said before, we have so many stars in our own galaxy alone, and they're like billions of stars. And then if you say, okay, every second one has a planet, then we're going with billions of planets in our galaxy alone, and as you mentioned before, there are billions of galaxies out there. And so, as another visual image, if you've just been on the beach recently, take all the grains of sand that you find there, and then take all the pebbles and all the rocks on the Earth, pile them up. It's not as many as there are stars out there. And then, you know, if you want, just half that huge pile. And that's what we think, how many planets are out there as well. So it's an enormous number, and it will teach us a lot about generally what planets are like, but hopefully also what's in the store for the future of the Earth, and of course, whether or not there's life out there or not.
So all that kind of thinking can make you dizzy, practically. But in addition, you're estimating things based on every other star having one planet, but our own star has, what, 9 planets? I mean, there could be multiple planets around every other star, and my gosh, it could be unbelievable. But in addition, I'm wondering, how about big moons around large planets? Are some of the bigger moons possibly habitable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great question. So one of the things we found is that we already have more than 400 systems out there, so planetary systems. Like our own seem to be the norm out there. It seems actually to be rare that there's only one planet around a star. But, you know, for a lot of these systems, we haven't found all the small planets yet, so we can say. But for a lot of systems, so more than 400, actually roughly 500 now, we find that they have more than one planet, so are much more like our own solar system, if you want. But it's not only that. As you just mentioned, what about moons? Because in our own solar system, we are all excited about moons, for example, about Titan or Europa, so the moon around Saturn and Jupiter, where there could potentially be life subsurface on the icy moons, or maybe life as we don't really know it on a moon like Titan. And there are so many planets out there. For a planet itself, for us to actually be able to pick up the signatures of life in the atmosphere, the things that life breathes in and breathes out, we are constrained to this habitable zone. Because if the planet freezes over, think about it, there's something that life breathes out in the ocean below it. It doesn't make it into the atmosphere. So without going there, drilling a hole and checking in the oceans, we won't be able to say whether or not there's life on such an icy planet or icy moon. But generally, having said that, this habitable zone that we're talking about is only to be able to remotely detect signatures of life. There could be way more life out there in areas that are too cold or too hot generally. But if you had a moon around, like a big moon around a giant planet, then that moon could be sheltered, or it could get additional heat, or it could, even if it's frozen, have subsurface life in the ocean. So it's not just the planets that are exciting for abodes of life, but the planets will give us the first ways to actually find that life very far away. Because on the moon, it's going to be even harder, because you don't only have to block out the light from the star, bright light source, so you need to block that out to find the light from the planet. But if you have a moon, you'd have to block out the light from the star and from the planet to get the light from the moon. But having said that, moons could definitely also be abodes for life. And, you know, if you've seen the movie Pandora, we are looking for green, blue, and all kind of colorful animals or human beings or humanoid beings, as you wish.
So, green and blue are the colors to look for.
I hope it's even more diverse than that, because you just have a look at the life on Earth, if you just go to the deep oceans, for example, they are species down there that make you wonder how life could evolve on another planet, because even on ours, the variety is astonishing sometimes. So I think sometimes when I see the sci-fi movies that I really like, it is very funny because all of them look like us. And I think that's mostly because you can't really put the actors in any other costume.
That's probably true. Or if you could, it'd be real hard to figure out how to pay them. But actually, that brings up something I wanted to ask you, though. Lisa, it always seems to me that we're kind of organocentric, as you were just really saying, not just thinking of external life as being human-like in some way, in the sense of having a body and head and arms and legs, but that we think life basically needs to be carbon-based and require liquid water and oxygen, and generally be something we'd recognize as being Earth-like life. And I know you said earlier that there are forms of life that aren't really organic, or at least aren't bacterial and that kind of thing, but isn't it possible that there might be forms of life that are wholly different from anything we'd recognize? I mean, I don't know, energy forms or something like that. I mean, something that is really science fiction-y that could exist on planets and on bodies in space that aren't Earth-like.
So I think generally everything we know is, of course, based on the biology we have on Earth. And so it's carbon-based, and we have water as a solvent. There are two arguments here. So one is actually that carbon is very versatile to make these long chains that actually can make all these complicated chains and molecules and, you know, things that you need to actually develop life. But on the other hand, you could say, what about some other chemicals? And it turns out that carbon is actually pretty unique in what it does, at least, you know, listening to biologists, so this is not really my area of expertise. And then water is also a very good solvent, because it has a couple of really interesting properties that make it the solvent of choice, if you want. But if you look at it as an astronomer, again, so I don't have a biology degree, but if you look at it as an astronomer, you look around in the galaxy and in the universe, and you find hydrogen and water kind of everywhere, and you find carbon kind of everywhere. So the question really turns around on you, and it's like, what about if life was using something else, like, for example, silicate? What would it take for life to leave the huge abundant stuff like carbon and water, just leave it there and not use it, and use something that's not as abundant? Because we also have silicates, for example, on the Earth, but life chose to use the abundant carbon and the abundant water. And again, this is one of the really interesting parts of the search. We're looking out there for signatures of life, and we're also keeping our eyes open for signatures we can explain that could indicate life based on other biochemistry. But having talked to some biologists lately, they haven't really come up with what it could be, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. And as you said, beings based on energy or something else, if you take that out, for example, Star Trek, I think we'll have the hardest time recognizing them, because if I remember my science fiction correct, they had the hardest time when they landed and had a look at the havoc that was wreaked on the instruments, what was going on. So I think that will be a bit further off in the future than finding the signatures of life in the atmosphere of these small planets. What will still take us 5 to 10 years for the next big telescopes to be actually up in space, the follow-up of Hubble, or built on the ground? Because right now we can do this atmospheric characterization for giant planets like Jupiter, because there's just more atmosphere there, so it gives us a better signal. But we need a bigger telescope. If you think of a telescope just as a bucket for light, we need bigger telescopes to actually do that for the small, to me, fascinating planets that could resemble a second Earth out there.
Well, even looking for what you're looking for is hard enough, and it is probably fruitful enough in the end that it would take many lifetimes to begin to even explore it fully. So if we run across other things on the way, that would be serendipitous, but it's impossible to speculate about such things in a way that gives you a plan of attack for your research, right? So
absolutely, because at the end of the day, what you need to do is you need to come up with something that you look for, that your telescope can look for. So you build something for very Earth-centric few, and then, of course, you have a look at anything else, anything that sounds interesting or unexplainable. That's usually the serendipity in research, right? So you look for something specific, and then you keep your eyes open to learn more about other planets in this case.
So, Lisa, we just have a minute or so left, but I gather that the telescope Kepler in space has found some of the most Earth-like planets to date. What are they like? I mean, what are the characteristics of what that telescope finds?
We live in an amazing time where we find a variety of planets already in the zone where it's not too hot and too cold, and we basically start to collecting them like eggs in a basket, if you want, and trying to figure out which of those could potentially be a second Earth, because there's really no way to tell yet which one's a better candidate than the other, as long as they're in the zone. So it's an exciting time.
I would say it is. Let me ask you one last question, really quick, short answer if there is one. Mm-hmm. Are we sure now that there's no life of any kind elsewhere in our solar system?
No, we're not sure, because we haven't explored subsurface areas yet. So on Mars, on Europa, on Titan, there could be life that we just haven't found yet.
Okay, fair enough. But it's not going to be little green men for sure. It would be tiny.
Little green worms?
Maybe, okay. We'll leave it there. I hate to leave it there. We could continue talking for a long time. I just want to say one little thing, that Dr. Kaltenegger is so well-regarded in astronomy that she even has an asteroid named after her. Not too many people can say that, and let's hope it never decides to come pay her a visit, huh? So
that was the only thing I made sure before they named it. I was like, can you tell me that it's never going to come crashing down on the Earth? Because I do want to know that if somebody says Kaltenegger is coming, nobody's really scared.
Well, they couldn't say no for sure, but you let them name it after you anyway. So, all right.
Absolutely.
Everybody out there, you can Google Earth-like planets and find a lot of information on this subject. But I have to leave it there, so I want to thank you, Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger, for being on with us on American Variety. It's been fascinating.
You're more than welcome. Thank you so much for asking.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.